After 9 years of suffering or crimes, it's like a sign to counter this impunity and to send the message that this perpetrator will be held accountable one day. And it's important, especially in this moment now. I think it's justice and effort that's needed for protecting the human rights.
Welcome back to Rightscast. I'm here with Jumana Saif and Andrea Schuler from the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights. Thank you both very much for joining me.
Thank you very much for having us.
So we're here today to talk about a universal jurisdiction case that is happening at the moment in Germany involving two former members of the Syrian regime. Before we get into that, would you be able to just introduce yourselves?
My name is Saif. I'm a Syrian lawyer. I have been working with ECCHR as a research fellow since May 2017, and with special focus on sexual and gender-based violence.
Yeah, hello, and my name is Andreas Schüller. I work with ECCHR for more than 10 years now on international crimes and accountability, and we've started our work in 2012 already on Syria, and then in 2017, we made it a big priority, now resulting in the first trials and results.
So I suppose by way of introduction, would you be able to just tell us a little bit about the facts of the case?
The trial in Koblenz is about state torture in Syria. It's about two former officials of Bashar al-Assad, the General Intelligence Director. Anwar R is suspected to be complicit in the torture of at least 4,000 people. It's between 2011 and 2012 in the General Intelligence Al-Khatib branch, which is in Damascus. This torture resulted to the death of 58 people and also included cases of sexual violence. Iyad A, the colleague of Anwar Ruslan, has been charged with torture in at least 30 cases.
It's a phenomenal number of people in a relatively short period of time.
Yeah, it's about 1 year, 1.5 years.
What are the kind of key things or issues that are likely to be addressed, and how long do you see it lasting?
I think that the case will address a lot of things, which is really important for the Syrian also to be public and to be discovered from the court. Torture, systematic torture and killing and cases of sexual violence also to be addressed in the court, and the evidence gathered by seizure and many other evidence. And I think it's the trial itself will answer a lot of questions that Syrian that they have. It's like how the system is ongoing, who give the order, how the decision making process, all of this, where is the bodies of the victims themselves. It's like many questions will be raised, will be addressed, and I think the whole case, it will take a long time because we have a lot of testimonies, we have a lot of witnesses, and still a lot of survivors, they express their willingness even to join. So I think it's opened the door for justice and give the hope for the Syrian and encourage them to really engage more and to give more. So I think it's just a start.
Yeah, it's difficult also to predict how long it will last. It could easily be 1, 2, or 3 years. It really depends also how the defendants will appear, if they give statements, and if they confess or not, and other issues. But as Jumana said, there's a lot of evidence that will be heard anyway, so it will last at least easily for a year. But the experience from other universal jurisdiction trials is also that it could also be up to 3 or 4 years for the first instance, and then it would even on appeal take another 2 years or something like that.
And the case is brought under the principle of universal jurisdiction, which I guess really came to fame in the late 90s, also in a torture-related case to do with Pinochet. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about what universal jurisdiction is and how universal jurisdiction is applied in Germany?
Yeah, universal jurisdiction was introduced in German law in 2002 in parallel with the entry into force of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. So it's basically the German domestic law putting Germany in a position also to prosecute international crimes such as genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity domestically.
How did the case end up being tried in Germany?
So the universal jurisdiction law in Germany is pretty open. It basically doesn't, by law, require any link to Germany. So every international crime committed worldwide could fall under German jurisdiction. And it's then a discretionary decision by the prosecutor whether they want to investigate and prosecute a case or not. And they usually then require a certain connection to Germany. And this connection here in the Syrian cases we had, for example, because many, many survivors of international crimes, but also some of the perpetrators are living in Germany. So you have a very strong link established to Germany, basically. And that was the reason why here the cases under the principle of universal jurisdiction were taken up by the Office of the Prosecutor, and also following, of course, a lot of complaints and demands by civil society organization, by survivors organization, who provided then information and evidence to the prosecutor to conduct the investigations.
It must be quite difficult, I suppose, to prepare a universal jurisdiction case in the sense that you don't necessarily know, say, when you started this case, did you know that the two perpetrators were in Germany, or how do you go about preparing the file?
Yeah, you start from the overall situation and then you also see a bit where the cases and the information leads you. So basically, when we started in 2012 to work on Syria, we saw what's happening there, kind of in real time. And then soon after, also the first witnesses and survivors came to Germany and we started to represent them so that they gave already their testimonies in this so-called structural investigation, which is on the situation, but not on individual perpetrators, so that evidence can be collected. And then in 2017, basically with four criminal complaints, we specified the direction of the investigations, following a lot of discussion with Syrian activists, survivors, and groups to strategize which cases we should select, what are the strongest ones, which ones have the biggest impact. So basically, we came up with a number of complaints against several of the Syrian secret services, Air Force Intelligence, for example, but also now the Im al-Khatib branch, where you have the current case now going on in Germany. So basically, you look into the situation, you strategize with local actors, activists to select cases. You build the cases by finding evidence and researching the chain of command. And in that, then it happened that the two persons were arrested in Germany, and we immediately had a number of survivors who could give testimonies on the two individuals, which then basically started the investigation.
What's ECCHR's specific role in it? Do you represent a number of victims or all of the victims?
ECCHR, it's now supporting 17 of plaintiffs and civil party, supporting them legally and also supporting them with collaboration with other centers, with psychosocial support, and provide them the full support on that and work with them very closely.
We worked a lot also in the background to get to this stage. So as I said, in 2012, already engaging with the German prosecutor and war crimes unit to make it an issue there so that they started their work and investigation. In 2017, with the complaints filed and two very large events we had in Germany to support those complaints and to get also the political backing behind those cases, including, of course, also the resources for the prosecutor's office and the war crimes unit's office. So there's an ongoing direct work with a lot of survivors so that they can attend, that they are informed about what's happening. But also beyond that, it's basically politically to give the backing to such trials, to organize support, including for the authorities, but also to critically accompany what the authorities are doing, be it the prosecutor and also the courts, the judges, how they react. And then what I've mentioned before, the international outreach, so that also decision makers and those interested globally basically get the information about the trial and the context and the meaning of it.
In terms of the practicalities, I'd imagine taking a universal jurisdiction case, it's quite different to a normal case. You know, if something happens within your own territory, just, you know, in terms of ease of access to evidence or witnesses. What do you kind of see are the key differences and the challenges in bringing such a case?
Yeah, each case is different. Here, actually, a lot of witnesses are living in Germany or at least in the EU, so they are kind of easily accessible. There are other universal jurisdiction cases where witnesses and evidence are outside Europe, which is even more complicated. So from that perspective, there are some advantages compared to other universal jurisdiction cases here. And of course, that many survivors and victims are also living now in Germany and around the court, basically. So it's not so distanced as often universal jurisdiction cases are. I mean, of course, it's still distant to where the crime's happening and where the perpetrators are from and had their support. And it's also the aim to report back to Syria and at one point also have such trials in Syria. But the distance you often have in universal jurisdiction cases is a bit narrower here because there are so many Syrians in Germany, in Europe, including also witnesses.
If I can add also, just to take into consideration that a lot of refugee, that Syrian refugee are also, they had to flee. It's like a huge number of survivors that arrived to Germany, to Europe. Mm. And the majority, they have their story. They have this really bad experience or ordeal. So that they are looking to fight for justice and then fight against impunity in Syria and provide something for the process for achieving justice.
It is, you're right. I hadn't thought about it before, but it is really unique, you know, in terms of even the number of Syrians in Germany compared to the rest of Europe. It's a really dramatic difference, and presumably quite a large population of Syrians outside of the immediate vicinity of Syria itself. And so you work quite a lot with Syrian organizations and different groups.
Yeah, absolutely. From the very beginning, there was a bridge between Syria and Germany through a number of activists. The first ones that arrived in Germany, building their own networks. And then also in 2016, 2017, with people like Jumana and others joining. Also ECCHR, we had a very close relationship to Syrians living all across Europe and beyond. And there's a constant daily exchange with quite a number of lawyers, activists, survivor groups, those researchers documenting. It's a large pool of information, but it's also a large group to exchange about strategic decisions in the litigation, but also about the meaning of such a trial and the outreach around such a trial to make it worthwhile.
I presume it's quite a significant trial for Syrians and people interested in accountability. Would you be able to talk a little bit how it fits into the bigger advocacy picture, or I suppose what it means to people who have been affected by the conflict?
Yeah, I think for the Syrian, we all know that it's like all these kind of crimes as crimes of against humanity. The Syrian have been suspected from 2011 and with the start of the revolution. A lot of torture crimes with tens of intelligence branches. And unfortunately, from the very beginning with the political solution, what they try and the first plan that was provided from Annan at the beginning focused on the detainees and these crimes which were committed in Syria. And the Syrian, they try to do a lot. The activists try to document it, to preserve, to secure this evidence. And from the beginning, they were looking for the justice. And unfortunately, all these crimes were committed and still committing before the eyes of the international community, and nothing happened. So it's a visible step that at least there is some people, they are stand up for justice and supporting them with their suffering. That's, it's like just from 9 years till now.
I suppose even though it's only two individuals, it's the first trial, as I understand it, of former regime officials. So it's the first time that anyone associated with Assad has been put on trial is particularly significant.
Yeah, I think it's like when it comes for the crimes against humanity, war crimes, it's not about two people, but I think it's the trial for the regime himself, for all this torture machine, for the system in general. It's very necessary, I think, also to recording the truth and declaring it to the world. I think it's very important for the victims and will help them to recover from their trauma, at least to restore their dignity, to feel that, there is a hope they will achieve justice, even it's very limited now. I think it's very important, and a lot of witnesses, a lot of survivors, even Syrian who are affected people, relatives of victims, also they sent us to say it's a thank you. It's now we start now to relieve, to recovery. It's very important for knowing the truth. It's very important signal to say that at least it's a start for the justice.
So I suppose it's about not only just the process of the trial itself, but the broader impact of it and the awareness. I guess one of the things I've always been impressed by with ECCHR is the focus not just on law, but also on the broader awareness raising or the advocacy element too. You know, it's not necessarily a purely or exclusively legal approach. Could you talk maybe a little bit about, you know, what you do around the case in terms of awareness raising or advocacy here?
Yes, I mean, absolutely. It's an important element that we are not only supporting the civil parties joining the trial and being a party to the trial. That's one aspect and element, definitely, so that victims can exercise their rights in such a trial. But on the other hand, of course, it's also to contextualize what's happening there in the courtroom and what that means. Romana pointed already to the significance of the trial for survivors, for victims' families, and not only those represented in the trial, but way beyond, because it's indeed the first time that regime perpetrators are standing trial and are faced with allegations and quite personal, touching accounts of torture and killings. But on the other hand, of course, it's also kind of a crack in the system of impunity in this regime. And I think that in the longer term is also the message that what's happening there does not go unpunished and unaccounted for. So it's always a bit difficult because the trial is in German. It's not broadcast. There's not even a transcript of each hearing. So it's quite limited to what's happening in the courtroom. I mean, it's of course open to the public, but again, you need to understand German or Arabic if some Arabic witnesses see one or the other day. So what we try to do is to accompany the trial with a number of outreach measures, such as it's participating in this podcast. Also on our website, we have in three languages, German, English, and Arabic, a short summary of each trial day. So just the basic fact so that everyone can follow what's happening in court. There will be a number of other events also live streamed. There are workshops we have with larger number of Syrian organizations to brief them, to answer questions directly to them so that they can then further communicate to their members and audiences. And there was, of course, also already a lot of communications and outreach work around the trial opening with press conferences, with quite a number of interviews to national and international media reporting about it. Again, here also bridging the gap from the courtroom to international media that can't travel at the moment to Germany to attend the trial in person, which is another challenge. So there are quite a number of different measures to communicate basically what's happening in the trial, but also to contextualize it, why it is important and what it means for Syria at the moment, with still thousands of people in detention, for the future of Syria, that those crimes don't go unpunished, for survivors to be heard, for perpetrators to be faced with the truth and with what happened in detention. So that all comes together and we try to approach different audiences with what's happening in the trial.
This work forms part of your broader work on accountability for Syria generally. Do you work with other organizations in other countries to bring cases there? Or do you have plans to bring further cases within Germany itself?
Yeah, we always saw it as an European approach to international crimes committed in Syria. So ECCHR filed cases in Germany first, but then also in Austria, Sweden, and Norway. And we are in touch with the war crimes units there. There are ongoing investigations. We are also closely collaborating with partners like Trial International in Switzerland or FIDH in France that are supporting cases there. Also together then with the Syrian partner organizations such as SCM, which is also quite active in France, in Germany, together with us also in the other jurisdictions. And we also looked into corporate crimes in the context of the conflict. So there was one case filed against the Utimaco in Germany on surveillance technique for the Syrian regime, and also the Lafarge case in France. ECCHR, together with Sherpa, is actively involved in against the company doing business in ISIS-held territories. And last but not least, we also looked into airstrikes by the anti-IS coalition and their duties to investigate right-to-life violations from a human rights perspective after the strikes with organizations such as Air Wars. So basically, it's a big network. It's certainly a European approach we're going for, that not only Germany, but also the European war crimes units should coordinate among themselves. I mean, witnesses and evidence are spread out in different countries, so it needs coordination anyway to build those cases, especially in a situation where the International Criminal Court cannot fulfill this role because Syria never ratified the statute and the Security Council never came to an agreement to refer the situation to the International Criminal Court. So basically, it's looking into the European approach, but also to involvement of European corporations into the conflict and also European states, basically, in its part in the anti-IS coalition.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think both angles, you know, the corporate angle, what type of charges do you bring against corporate actors? Are they criminal charges or is it civil?
Yeah, in those cases, these were criminal charges. And often it's then rather for aiding and abetting, of course, not for direct perpetratorship. It's difficult, of course, to find the connections and all of that. But on the other hand, it's also absolutely necessary to look into the economic and financial aspects of wars, who's financially benefiting from it, and where those are situated. And often enough, they are also in Europe. So we certainly also see it as one of our main tasks to go after those in Europe that are profiting from such a conflict.
Yeah, I think the process of investigating corporate actors, like you say, identifying the linkages and so on, must be really, really difficult. I wanted to finish by chatting a little about universal jurisdiction itself. Universal jurisdiction, I suppose, enjoyed a really prominent moment in the late 90s and early 2000s, and there was a lot of interest in universal jurisdiction, a large number of cases. And then it kind of seemed to fade away a bit. You know, there was kind of high-profile changes to legislation in a number of countries, I think from memory, Belgium, Spain, and the UK being a couple. And over the last couple of years, there's been a resurgence, primarily linked, I think, to the conflict in Syria. Do you think this is a turning point that, you know, universal jurisdiction is being reestablished?
Well, I think universal jurisdiction is quite dynamic and there are different phases you can describe. So there were these high profile cases such as Pinochet with the arrest in London in 1998, arrest warrants against General Videla and others from the Argentinian junta in Germany in 2003. So those high profile cases at the time. And then in the 2000s, basically, it became more structured with the EU Genocide Network, more war crimes units and more European jurisdiction. Changes in legislation make universal jurisdiction in some states, such as Belgium and Spain, less likely. In other states, such as France, Germany or Sweden, more likely. So there's a gradual shift. And what we see now is also an approach by many states basically only to prosecute suspects that are or happen to be on their territory. It's more like more opportunistic. So you take the cases that are there. It's less strategic in a sense that you go after those bearing the kind of greatest responsibility for the crimes that are mostly systematic crimes. But in the Syrian cases, fortunately, in Germany, there's not only the trial in Koblenz, but there's also an arrest warrant out, for example, against Jamil Hassan, the former Air Force intelligence chief. Against him, we also filed a case. And basically to say, look, that's the highest level of responsibilities and investigations should go into that direction and not only target those you happen to find on your territory. So it's coming from two sides. One is the prosecution of those present on your territory, but then also more strategically going after those at highest positions of intelligence services or armies and try to, through arrest warrants, get extraditions to also have them standing trials. So there's a gradual development in universal jurisdiction, but of course it also remains to be seen whether war crimes units will be willing in the future to take up more cases that are, from a foreign policy perspective, less favorable because it would go against maybe even some of their allies committing war crimes rather than against members of states where you don't have any diplomatic ties anyway. So that would be the crucial test, I think, for universal jurisdiction, whether it's always in line with foreign policies or whether it will also be exercised from a pure legal perspective on those basically responsible for grave human rights violations.
I suppose, like, taking an optimistic perspective, the fact that these cases are ongoing and that different war crimes units are building up experience and expertise, I suppose, in actually prosecuting the cases and being comfortable with it, hopefully that bodes well for taking on the more politically sensitive cases in the future. I can't remember the last time I heard of a case where a warrant was issued for somebody who wasn't on the territory. Not in recent years. I think it was probably some of the Spanish cases, but that's from memory, you know, 8-9 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. The arrest warrant against Jamil Hassan, that was a major step back into the direction to really go where the responsibility for an enormous amount of torture and killings lies. And that was an extremely important step by the German federal prosecutor to go that way, to gather all the evidence you need to get such an arrest warrant by the German Supreme Court. And they have pretty high standards, so you need to do your homework, certainly, to get this issued. But that happened, and that was certainly a great sign. But we also hope that there will be some follow-up steps when it comes to extradition requests, either to Syria or to other countries where he might travel. And under the UN Convention Against Torture, of course, there would even be potentially a way to the ICJ for Germany to put more pressure on Syria and to bring the torture issue before the ICJ if they are not prosecuting or extraditing him. So we think it's quite significant, but there are a number of steps that need to follow also in that direction to get basically close to Assad, who still enjoys his head of state immunity for the time being. But that's certainly the circle where the highest responsibility for all these crimes lies, and where also prosecutions and accountability needs to target, basically.
Interesting. It's exciting times.
As a Syrian also, we are looking for further arrest warrants, especially against the high-ranking officials, and also do the same more investigation in the European country like Sweden, like Norway, like Austria. That's, we think, a universal jurisdiction and its dynamics to really give us the hope of justice. And as Andreas mentioned, it's the only solution or legal path that we have. So really, we are appreciated through all the effort that is ongoing now, and the role of the German prosecutor and a lot of Syrians. They really express their appreciation and also their hope to have another investigation, another trials in other European countries.
Really, I think it's like after Koblenz, it's something different, and I can feel that with the Syrian in general. We hope it would be start for further arrest warrant, further investigation, and also as the only path that will stand up for justice to give the hope of the Syrian that they are with us, because it's like nothing helped to stop this torture machine for 9 years.
I suppose for you, like as a Syrian lawyer, it must be quite an important moment.
Yes, really. It's like after 9 years of suffering or crimes, and still now the statistic, the estimation, it's still 130 missing people still, at least. It's like forcibly disappeared in the detention centers of the Syrian regime. So at least it shows, it's like a sign to counter this impunity and to send the message that this perpetrator will be held accountable one day. And it's important, especially in this moment now. I think after 9 years and with the block of, ICC, any special tribunal. So I think at least it's justice and effort it's needed for protecting the human rights in general, values and, yeah, justice. So, yeah, we hope that it's a very good start in the right way.
Yeah, well, that's incredible work. I wish you both the best of luck with the plans going forward.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Rightscast from the University of Essex Human Rights Centre. For more coverage of this case, ECCHR are providing daily updates on the Al-Khatib trial on their website, which you can find in the description of this episode. You can subscribe to Rightscast and find more of our episodes on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please share with your friends and leave us a review if you feel like it. We'll be back soon with more regular episodes.